G'day everyone and welcome back to 2022. We're entering our third year now here at a Neurophysio podcast, which just feels surreal. Our goal has always been to share thought-provoking work with you that you and I can both translate into clinical practice and highlight the range of career pathways available.
More recently, we've been expanding beyond neurophysio, interviewing guests from different health professions and experts in various clinical areas, and we look forward to bringing you more of that in 2022. We have episodes on the way about multiple sclerosis, consumer perspectives, constraint-induced movement therapy, and also with leading clinical trialists. Meanwhile, this month's release is all about adults with cerebral palsy with leading Melbourne local, Professor Prue Morgan from Monash University. But first, our reflections on Annie McCluskey's episode from December. Matt?
I love the OT physio banter back and forth. I know that, you know, I've said this before a few times, I am married to an OT, so I've got a vested interest in it. But I think that the way that we can complement each other in practice and benefit our patients is just really, really nice, which was a lovely sort of call to arms at the end that Annie was talking about. So I really loved that on a personal note for me.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you. And I'm not married to an OT, but I have had so many OT mentors over my career that I've learned so much from, and that's mainly from doing co-treatments and working very closely on patient care with them. So yeah, that was a really great point. I also really loved Annie's encouragement of junior physios and other clinicians getting really involved in knowledge translation and, I guess, kind of rocking the boat, so to speak, rather than conforming to the practices in their local organisation, wherever they're working, but instead to challenge some of the existing practices, and that senior and other types of clinicians should also be doing this. But I really liked Annie's notion that it's the junior therapists, as they're coming fresh out of university, that can have a really big impact there.
Yeah, I like that idea. It's going to be junior physios that are going to take us forward, and with all the technology that's coming along, they're the ones that are going to drive it, I think, from within. So I really look forward to that. So on to 2022. Professor Prue Morgan is Head of Department of Physiotherapy at Monash University in Melbourne. She's had an extensive clinical career in neurological physiotherapy and is an expert in adults with cerebral palsy, with a PhD in falls and mobility decline in this population. She has a Master's of Applied Science and Research, a Graduate Diploma in Neuroscience, and is a Neurology Fellow in the Australian College of Physiotherapy, a program she is now an assessor on.
Prue's areas of interest and current projects include falls and balance dysfunction in adults ageing with cerebral palsy, workforce development within the NDIS, and evaluating clinical skill teaching methods in undergraduate physiotherapy. A self-described yes woman, she sat on many committees, councils, and working groups for projects like the Stroke Guidelines and World Physiotherapy. And she's completed a prestigious Travelling Churchill Fellowship in 2016. We cover most of these areas in this episode, so let's not waver any longer and get right into it. We wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands we recorded this episode on. Matt and I were on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land, and Prue was on Boonwurrung land. Both areas are part of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to both groups, recognising their continued connection to the land and waters of these areas, and acknowledge that they never ceded sovereignty. We also pay our respects to elders past and present.
Before we begin, the people we interview on this podcast are representing their own views, thoughts and opinions as individuals, which are not necessarily the views of organisations or committees that they are associated with. Equally, the advice and information shared on this podcast is general only and should not be considered as medical advice. Welcome to a Neurophysio podcast. My name is Matt Wingfield.
And I'm Erin Bicknell. Welcome to the show, Professor Prue Morgan.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Prue, I'm going to go out on a limb here and label you as Melbourne neurophysio royalty. You've worked at Melbourne's biggest hospitals. You're a neurology fellow in the Australian College of Physios. You're head of department for the physio course at Monash University. And also through your tireless research, your clinical expertise and your volunteer work, you're recognised as one of the biggest advocates for adults with cerebral palsy internationally. So where do we start? Can you take us back? How did you get to where you are today?
That's a really interesting question. And with my almost new graduates that are about to come out of university this week or maybe next week, they've been asking, you know, can you give me some tips for your career or how did you get into neurophysio? And I'm like, actually, I never really started off wanting to be a neurophysio. Back in the mid 80s, neurophysio wasn't actually that trendy. It was, you know, not really an area of practice that was appealed to me. All through physio school, the only thing I wanted to be a pediatric physio. You know, I loved working with children. I really enjoyed my pediatric rotation at the Royal Children's Hospital. And I got my dream job. I got a new graduate position at the Royal Children's Hospital as soon as I finished. And I thought, wow, I'm set here. I'll just, you know, follow, you know, other royalty such as Anne McCoy, who many will know very well. But after a couple of years of that, I got a bit restless and I realised, although I really enjoyed working with children, I really didn't enjoy so much working with their parents. And I think I was just not mature enough. And so I followed the typical journey that many physios do. You go, you work for a couple of years in a hospital and then off you go overseas. And I headed off to England. And it was interesting that that's when I first started to think about, oh, actually, what do I want to do? Because again, you go to England, you get a locum job. You say, what sort of locum job would you like? I'm like, wow, I can only really do paediatrics. And there weren't any locum jobs in paediatrics. So I thought, well, maybe I could sort of do neuro because it's sort of like big paediatrics. And so I started doing some short-term, you know, locums in neuro in UK. And when I came back to Melbourne, I thought, well, I'm sort of locked now into doing, you know, neuro or peds, and I was offered a job as a grade 2 neuro at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. I said, oh, I'm not really sure that I want to do it. I'll take it as a 1 month locum. And 12 years later, I eventually left. So, yeah, I got bitten by the neuro bug.
So from there, that's when you sort of fell in love with neuro, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I worked alongside colleagues such as Professor Jenny McGinley, trailblazing. You know, we set up a new stroke unit. It was all very brand new. Colleagues like, you know, Julie Bernhardt were similarly working at, you know, at other major teaching hospitals at the time. We were all trying to work out how we could best provide care for patients in these new stroke units and how it would work. And yeah, it was exciting times.
So one of the questions we've got then is obviously all the CP stuff that you're so renowned for. Where did that come through? I've been working in, you know, acute tertiary hospitals around Melbourne and I don't think I saw one adult CP person through my time when I was there.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And, you know, as my career sort of progressed, I moved into, had young children and I was not wanting to work full time. And I was offered an opportunity to set up the Falls and Balance Clinic at Kingston Centre, which is now part of Monash Health in Melbourne. And at that time, it was, you know, a clinic, as many of these clinics are, designed specifically for gerontology clients. I thought, yep, that'll suit me. I'm happy to go and do that one day a week. And, you know, I think I had pretty good skills in knowing what would be sort of minimum data set for Falls clients. And, you know, with the work of colleagues such as Keith Hill, who was, you know, setting up similar Falls and Balance clinic around Melbourne at the time, I thought I can do this. And, you know, elderly patients with complex falls were referred to us. But then I started seeing other sorts of patients who were being referred to us, such as 30-year-olds with cerebral palsy who were having increasing falls, or a 40-year-old with cerebral palsy who was having mobility decline, or, you know, a 45-year-old woman with cerebral palsy who had acute fear of falling because she'd had repeated falls. And perhaps in my naivety, this was obviously in the relatively sort of early 2000s, I said, oh, look, this isn't the place for you. I'll find the right place for you. You know, this is a gerontology clinic. And of course, I'm sure listeners won't be surprised, you know, there was no other place for this population. And so that sort of sparked my interest. And I eventually thought, gosh, surely we can do better than this. You know, we can obviously provide, you know, quality care for people with cerebral palsy as children. We're pretty red hot, I think, at, you know, providing, you know, good adolescent care and lots of sort of early intervention. Why can't we provide good quality care for adults? Because, you know, 75% of people living with cerebral palsy in Australia are adults.
Your experience with PEDS prior to that, I anticipate that you would have seen a lot of children with CP through that part of your career as well. Did that blend in, and did you know that there was this kind of drop off in care for adults with CP when you were working in PEDS?
No, I think I was absolutely ignorant of it. I think maybe when you're in, and it may not be the same now, but at the time, you know, you're in your little pediatric bubble. And, you know, you're providing the best care that you can to the patient in front of you. But, you know, it was not my problem what happened to them once they turned, you know, 18 or 19. And so I totally was ignorant of certainly the potential for new physical problems to arise throughout adulthood. I mean, you know, I'd learnt at university and that, you know, cerebral palsy, it's not a progressive disease. It's a disease or a disorder that occurs to the developing infant brain. So why on earth should young adults with CP present with any new problems? So no, I was totally ignorant.
And then you're a bit further on in your career, perhaps a little bit older and wiser and much more experienced. When you were setting up that Falls and Balance clinic, what spurred you to go that next step, and what did you do then to try and fill this gap for adults with CP?
Yeah, and so that certainly coincided with my transition into academia. I was looking for a new challenge. You know, my children were now a little bit older, so new challenge. Maybe let's start up a new university program and write the neurology content for a new program. And so
you're a sucker for punishment, it sounds.
As I said, it you know, perhaps serendipitously coincided with me moving into academia, and with a bit of nudging from colleagues, they said, well, Prue, if you're actually wanting to, you know, work and, you know, demonstrate or investigate what actually is going on with this population, if you can't find the answer, you'll have to provide the answer. So I then enrolled in a PhD.
And is it the... I look at the couple of CP patients that come through our hospital that we treat, and they're some of the most complex patients. So is it the complexity you think that may just stay with this as your focus of saying this is really the area that can dedicate most of your research life and clinical life to trying to fill the gap?
Yeah, no, that's a really good good question. And I think it perhaps was the complexity. I mean, just like stroke, you know, cerebral palsy, it's not a homogenous condition. And so to find a person-centred solution to some of the problems that they present with, you know, certainly does put significant demands on all of your clinical expertise. And also, you know, I think you're dealing with not a unique population, but a population who have, you know, spent their entire lives living with, not always, but often, disordered musculoskeletal system. So, you know, you're not trying to address something that only happened yesterday. You're actually trying to think about, all right, what has actually gone on over your entire lifespan, and how can we make the best, or how can we work together to get you the best outcome for what you're wanting?
Yeah, I think that really leads into a question that we had. Do these cerebral palsy adults have a lot of neuroplastic potential to change, or are they patients that we should be looking at more of a compensatory model as far as the kinetics and kinematics to get them as functional or as participating as well as possible in the community? Where's the line there?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, and certainly it's been the topic of a lot of interesting debate amongst my colleagues over the last few years. You know, I think certainly for those who are more severely affected, you know, I think it is not, you know, reasonable to think that you will ever be able to achieve normal kinetics and kinematics in this population. You know, that's never going to happen. You know, there's good evidence to suggest that not only, May they have changes to their musculoskeletal system as a result of the different forces on their bones over their growing years. But also at a sort of microscopic level, there's also good evidence to suggest that their muscles are also not, you know, there are some different or unique changes to their muscles as well. And so, as I said, I think it's perhaps not reasonable to assume that you're going to be able to get sort of normal function. But absolutely, there is good evidence to suggest that you can optimise their function and that they absolutely have got capacity and the potential to gain sort of neuroplastic changes as a result of interventions, just like you or I or anyone else has.
Could we perhaps dig a little deeper into some of those components that you just spoke about? I think some outpatient clinics and potentially private practices around Australia and maybe internationally see a lot of neurological disorders of a range of presentations, probably predominantly stroke, and CP in adults might not come along all that often. So what are the sorts of key principles that clinicians should be thinking about when they're managing someone with CP who's an adult?
The most important thing is to have a good look at doing a really comprehensive sort of neuromuscular assessment and working out what are new problems and what are old problems. And again, you know, as we've talked about, you know, some they've been living their whole life with this condition. Some may have had more recent changes to their function. Some may have had sort of been relatively stable in their function for many years. But again, you know, obviously they can obviously present with acute pain from their crouch gait pattern, for example. They can get overuse injuries from, you know, chronic use of having to use forearm crutches, for example, or wheelchairs. And we're starting to learn a little bit more about fatigue and, in fact, how that is it's not just a, gosh, I'm feeling a bit tired because I did a lot of exercise yesterday, but it's a little bit more perhaps what we've typically thought of as fatigue in other neurological conditions like multiple sclerosis. And that's now coming through as a real and problematic issue, particularly for young adults with CP who are, you know, hoping to get into the workforce or have children, you know, run a household, all those sorts of things. They're starting to say to us, hey, I've actually got this real fatigue that I'm having really struggling with. So again, all of those issues, physios are really well placed to be able to address, let alone tackle some of the sort of underlying sort of neuromuscular disordered function that we're perhaps more comfortable in observing.
I love that because I think that's where the fun is for a lot of the clinicians is when you have got someone who's, as you said, you know, they've got different bone structure because of the loading of their bones over their entire development and how you then have to play with that and the mechanics of that to get someone as, you know, as independent as possible. That's so much fun for me as a clinician. But, you know, it's also like the whole world of, you know, seating prescription and making sure that they're supported and there's pressure injury relief and all things like that. You know, do you think we've got a role in that side of things as well, or should we leave that to our OT colleagues?
Oh, look, And obviously different facilities may, you know, allocate responsibility more differently, but absolutely we play a key role. And I just want to give a shout out to my recently graduated PhD student, Carly Holmes. And Carly's one of the senior physiotherapists at the Melbourne St Vincent's Hospital Young Adult Complex Disability Clinic. And she was particularly interested in how you provide quality care for people, particularly at the more profound end of severity with cerebral palsy, who may have quite confronting postural asymmetry, and how with skilled care, usually provided as part of a team, using bed positioning, wedges and other sort of equipment, you can actually make significant improvements, not only to their comfort and their pain, but also to obviously their function so that they can be more upright in their chairs, they can tolerate being sitting for longer periods of time, etc.
That's all coming out in Carly's PhD, is it?
Yes, it's all now published.
Oh, wonderful. So did she actually look at those sorts of interventions and what impact they had on outcomes?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously I don't want to share her results before she's ready, but, you know, she's done some great work. And even just looking at the importance of doing thorough pain assessments on nonverbal adults with cerebral palsy, again, I would say as a general statement that pain is underreported and undermanaged in that population, in those particularly who can't communicate for themselves. And, you know, I think we have a real obligation to ensure that if we are working with people, particularly who are nonverbal, that we do take the time to try and ascertain how they can communicate pain and comfort, and make sure that we're, you know, using that as an evaluation of outcome.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We've just had a patient through at my hospital under Dr. Steve DeGraff, and I'll say that in case people are struggling to find a pain specialist with a neurological bend as well who's trying to sort these patients out. So, you know, that was exactly the goal of our admission for this patient recently, is trying to find a pain management strategy which is going to facilitate her to still be able to participate in work and do all those sorts of things without knocking her out with different sedative drugs to avoid spasm and, you know, subsequent pain. So it's such a complex area, and people can find some good people to help them out.
And then do you think that's why fatigue also seemed to be a little bit of a hidden symptom for a long time? You were mentioning earlier, it's now starting to come out in the research, and adults with CP are telling us more about fatigue. But how do we start learning more about that? Why wasn't it recognised earlier?
Yeah, and again, you know, I'm not sure if you don't ask. Sometimes, you know, patients don't, particularly if you're a physio, they may not realise that you can offer them anything for their fatigue. You know, why would they bother telling you about their fatigue if they actually think that you've got no ability to change that for them or provide them with any strategies? Whereas I think with patients with multiple sclerosis, we're very upfront. You know, we're saying, hey, you know, do you have fatigue? I can help you with that. So certainly I think it was perhaps not well recognised. We didn't test for it. We didn't ask about it. And I think also many patients with CP thought it was just sort of their lot in life, you know, sort of grin and bear it. And some of them may well find that it's sort of tied to some of their drugs, you know, do have a sort of sedating or effect of sort of damping down their energy levels. You can imagine if you're particularly those with sort of dyskinetic cerebral palsy, if you're constantly moving, that obviously must burn through your metabolism and leave you quite exhausted at the end of every day. So, you know, it's again, it's quite a complex symptom, and I don't think there's a single answer that's going to solve it. But I think absolutely we should always be asking our patients with CP, is that an issue for them, and working with them on tailoring a solution.
Yeah, lovely. That's a really, I think, nice point, and really transitions into a question we had about all the barriers that exist for these patients or these people to, you know, integrate into the community and work and things like that. What other big barriers should clinicians be aware of and certainly be asking their patients when they present?
Yeah, and certainly, you know, I think over the past sort of 3 or 4 or 5 years at least in Australia, we've seen that there are a number of young adults with cerebral palsy, or maybe middle-aged adults with cerebral palsy, who've become quite disconnected from the health services, either because they had a perhaps less than positive time with the health service as children and it sort of burned them, or maybe they realised that there were very little resources for them in the health service. But now, at least with the NDIS, there is the potential for them to reconnect, at least with physiotherapy, and for us to work with them to be able to tackle some of the challenges that they now may be experiencing. And, you know, when I interviewed adults with cerebral palsy as part of my PhD, you know, I was asking them, you know, what's been your experience with working, you know, with finding physios who can, you know, help you, working with physios. And they often said, I don't bother. You know, I went to a private physio. They said they could help me with my back pain because, you know, I'm spastic diplegic. I put a lot of load through my back. They gave me a bit of treatment, but they said they couldn't help any further because they're not a pediatric physio. And so I think at least in the physio world, I think we're now gradually getting our act together and recognising that cerebral palsy, it's a lifespan condition. As I said earlier, 75% are actually adults. They're not in the pediatric age group. But it's about now helping young people with cerebral palsy or even older people with cerebral palsy identify practitioners who, even if they don't have the answers, they can help them find the answers. And so it's about, you know, identifying services that might suit their needs or working with them with resources and guidance and mentoring so that they can achieve whatever goals they're aiming to achieve.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the sort of call-outs that we've had on this podcast before is around patients, complex neurological patients presenting to musculoskeletal physios, private practices, and them not necessarily having the full skill set to treat them. So if by chance there's a musculoskeletal person listening to this, do you have any suggestions on resources that they can access or how they can find people who actually have more of a skill set in this area?
Or we should say any other physio, but also neurophysios that haven't worked with people with CP before as well, because there's a lot of us out there too.
Of course, very good point.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're absolutely floundering and you're not sure what to do, then obviously in the Australian Physio Association, the disability special interest groups, they're usually really set up very well across the lifespan. And they are incredibly knowledgeable. I'm on a Facebook group with the disability group. They're constantly, you know, making suggestions where people are asking help. You know, I've got a patient who lives in, you know, outback New South Wales. Can anyone, you know, direct me to someone who might be able to provide appropriate services? But if you're not able to connect in through the Australian Physio Association to some of those special interest groups, even things like, you know, some of the major tertiary hospitals, for example, here in Melbourne, you know, Monash Health and St Vincent's Hospital, they have complex disability specialist clinics, and even just touching base with the senior physio and getting their advice or direction as to, you know, who might be able to assist them would be another great strategy.
There's no sort of register of physios who are interested in working with adults with CP on the CP Alliance website or anything like that, is there?
No, not at the moment. The other thing just to say is that at the moment there's what's called the CP Info Project, which is, it's mainly a, it's going to be a fully online sort of web-based resource folder of everything to do with CP across the lifespan. It's very much targeted predominantly at people with cerebral palsy themselves and their families. But I would suggest if you're not familiar or you need perhaps a bit of a brush up, once that goes live, I think it'll be sometime in the first half, I think, of next year. That will be a great place to start as well. If you're just wanting, gosh, I'm feeling a bit lost here and I don't know what to do, then, you know, maybe even just going to some of the sort of consumer facing resources would also be a great strategy.
That sounds really cool, that project.
Will that project have resources that would be beneficial to people outside of Australia, particularly if in lower, you know, developed countries with, in terms of healthcare services? Would there be information helpful there for them?
Yeah, I imagine, obviously it's quite a massive project that's been funded like by government. It's aiming to try and draw together resources that are suitable for early intervention, so sort of preschool age, school age children, and then adults with CP. And absolutely the aim of it is to not necessarily provide sort of high-tech solutions or, you know, high-resource country solutions, but provide sort of a range of options that might be suitable for people who may come from a range of different backgrounds, including potentially outside of Australia.
And I think if I can just hijack the podcast for a second and say that if anyone from the UK or North America is listening that has resources that they're worth sharing, please put them up on our Twitter. You can add us at a neurophysio. And we'd like to get some sort of a resource bank going if there's not one there just in the interim for those people that are struggling with these guys because they are so complex.
Could I come back to your PhD, Prue? Were you trying to identify the gap in care through your PhD? Because you mentioned interviewing adults with CP and asking them about their experiences with physio. Like, what else did you find in your PhD?
Because it sort of had started at a Falls and Balance clinic, I was very much focused on what is actually going on. Like, why are young people with CP suddenly demonstrating change or decline in their balance? Like, I knew it should be a stable condition. So the first part of my PhD was to try and find out what do we know about falls in this population? What do we know about mobility and balance change over the lifespan in this population? And then the second phase was to pilot an intervention where I think earlier we were talking about the potential for neuroplasticity in this population. And so we certainly thought, well, might there be the potential for people to improve their balance? These were obviously ambulant adults with cerebral palsy, but we thought, I'm not sure if they're actually able to change their balance at all. But in fact, we designed a relatively low intensity, I think it was about an 8-week, 1 hour on a Saturday afternoon program in small groups. So 3 or 4 young adults with CP would come along. We'd design a program based on the best test results. So essentially whatever their area of deficit in the best test, we sort of thought, well, let's, you know, if it's reactive stepping, let's do some sort of reactive stepping exercises. Or if it's a dynamic balance walking with head turning, then let's practice walking with head turning. And in fact, we showed that they were actually able to improve their balance, and some of them quite significantly, which we found was quite surprising given that it was a relatively low intensive intervention. And what was really interesting was that there was one young man in particular in his mid-30s who was spastic diplegic. He walked with 2 forearm crutches. He had a lot of falls but had never really injured himself and wasn't that fussed because, you know, he was 30 and thought, oh, well, I'll just get myself up. I'm not going to kill myself. But he'd recently had a baby and he's thinking, oh, maybe it's not a great idea if I fall over while I'm carrying my baby. And he had been a really keen gym attender and he did weights at the gym religiously for years. He would go and do a weights program at the gym. But he said, wow, he said, I have never done these sorts of exercises before. And so it was really interesting that, as I said, as a result of what I would consider a fairly low intensity intervention over a relatively short period of time in someone with chronic balance dysfunction, that we were actually able to get some good changes, and that he found, you know, some of the skills that he learnt from those balance exercises really helpful at a functional level as well.
So these are some of the things that clinicians should really be thinking about, shouldn't they, when someone comes to see them? It goes back to the core principles, I guess, of our assessment and identifying where people's impairments are and their weaknesses and targeting our treatment to that. But yes, if someone hasn't been to a physio or another health professional for that assessment and they just keep going along with the exercise that they like to do, they might not actually be targeting things in the right way. So then how did that lead into academia for you, Prue? Did you start working at the university around that time as well?
Yeah. So I'd always really enjoyed teaching students at the bedside over my career. I thought, well, if I can influence 3 students at the bedside, how many more students could I possibly influence if I had a whole group of them? And so, you know, that I guess that sort of inspired. I thought it was maybe time for a change. And so I gradually, for a while, I was working part-time at the Falls and Balance Clinic and at Monash Health and part-time at the university, but gradually I transitioned and worked full-time then at the university as you know, I decided, no, maybe it's not so bad. I can work here and you know, learn some new skills.
And as you say, influence the next group of physios coming through.
And teaching is such a different set of skills, isn't it, to being a physio. I often say that to going, you know, people go to university for 3 or 4 years to become a teacher. We go there for 3 or 4 years to become a physio, and then we're expected to be able to teach. It's a challenge, isn't it? So talk to us about teaching and your philosophy with it, particularly for a lot of our listeners who will be having students at their clinical placements. How should we go about that? Is there any particular way that you would structure it to make a most successful clinical placement for your student?
Look, I think sometimes, and obviously, you know, different students have different abilities, and depending on where they are in their program, you know, you may focus on different aspects. But I think sometimes we underestimate the value of students observing a professional at work. And I think we get so keen on trying to give them as much hands-on practice as they possibly need and you know, can have. And obviously that's a really important aspect of it as well. But sometimes students learn a lot from just sitting back and watching a professional work. And so I think previously I might have just done some sort of demonstrations in the first few days of a placement, but then thought, oh, no, that's enough of that. Now, you know, you start doing stuff and I'll give you feedback and, you know, I'll see how you're going and I'll tell you what bits you need to improve on, rather than recognising that across a whole placement, you know, students still really benefit from observing a professional in an entire sort of intervention or an entire episode of care. And for me, that really links in very much to, I'm now obviously doing specialisation mentoring, and for the specialists trainees, often they've never had anyone watch them in their entirety. And so, you know, when you first are being watched by someone, you know, it can be quite threatening. And so I think, as my general message would be, I don't think it matters if it's a student watching a professional, you know, a qualified physio, a junior staff member observing a more senior staff member, a specialisation trainee, you know, observing a qualified specialist or vice versa. I think there's always things that we can learn from watching a sort of an entire episode of care and reflecting on what things we might have done differently, what things we might have learnt from that, and how we can sort of build it into our practice moving forward.
I love that as a clinician, having people come in and critique what I'm doing. I like to think that I'm not precious enough to think that I've got all the answers. And so I love it. I love having those really engaging conversations around, or I would have done that very differently to you, and here's why. And then, you know, having that discussion, I think that's a really valuable part. And I really want to try and engage my students to do that as well, of going, like, how would you do this based on how you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, understandably, you know, students often come into learning about neurology thinking that it's going to be a recipe, that if you have this result from a test, this is the treatment that you give. And so I think sometimes they find neurology a little bit mysterious, because there is no single treatment that you would give. You know, what I might give on one day, I might do something completely different the next day. And so, you know, I say to students, surely that's a benefit of doing neurology, because you can't ever go wrong. You know, you're always changing what you're doing. You know, there's no definite you must do this recipe.
It's an art form.
Yes.
The observing practice, does it have the same effect if you're doing a double together and one, like the clinician is, say, leading that more and the student is assisting? Does that have the same effect, do you think, or does it really have to be just observation and doing some of those tasks you said before, like writing down reflections and talking about it afterward?
Yeah, and as I said, I think, you know, I would weave in different opportunities through a clinical placement. So whereas as a rough guide, I would always try once a week for, doesn't matter where the student was in their placement, once a week have the student observe me doing a full treatment, or not necessarily me, a clinician doing a full treatment. But along with that, there may well, as you said, be opportunities for students to, you know, observe or critique or reflect on parts of treatments where they were perhaps assisting or perhaps not taking such a lead role.
And is there evidence that this observed practice does enhance learning over time, not just at the start of clinics?
There's different educational research showing the value of observation in improving practice. And whether it's sort of little, even just peer observation. So, you know, students often come in pairs, you know, they can still do some really valuable, you know, learning by observing their peer doing a treatment and having perhaps some more sort of scaffolded or structured reflection on that. But yeah, there's absolutely good evidence to suggest that it improves practice.
And is that what why some of the structure of the fellowship program is organized the way it is?
Yeah, and it's actually been really interesting that because of COVID, you know, a lot of the time we've not been able to be together with the mentor on site. And so some of the trainees have had to use a video and then go through the, I'm sure you've all had the same experience of agonizing watching yourself on video. And I think sometimes even just watching yourself on video is a really good experience as well. And so certainly we've used now some of those strategies to structure the specialisation program. It's very much about, you know, self-directed learning, identifying what are your goals, where you identify your deficits, seeking feedback from your mentor, having animated discussions about alternate treatment approaches. So it's very much looking at how you can develop not necessarily the most perfect set of skills right now, but a set of skills that will set you up for, you know, the ability to critique your own treatments and, you know, make good decisions about when something is being effective or when something is not being effective.
That makes me think back to episode one that we did 2 years ago, Erin, but that's okay, with James McLaughlin. And he was saying, he's talking about how that's a big part of his, you know, practice when he works clinically. But he's like, you know, you see a lot of these, you know, practices around where all the junior physios are clones of the senior physios, which is great because senior physios are usually pretty good. But, you know, I think he's talking about the same philosophy that you are of, you know, if you can find a challenge and something that's different in that, then it takes you to another level, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's been, you know, I don't claim that I've got all the answers, but I'm happy to discuss it and talk about treatment ideas or how I might go about, if something wasn't working, how I might go about actually finding a solution or finding something that is going to be more effective.
So do you find in the fellowship that there is resistance to those discussions from the participants, or are the people that are trying to do that know that they're there to improve and really value the feedback that's being provided?
Yeah, look, I would have to say that amongst neurology specialist trainees, there's a great philosophy. You know, it's very much, you know, we're all here to learn. As I said, I don't claim to have all the answers. I'm in a mentor role. You know, my job is to try and guide specialists to direct them as to where they might find the answers if they don't have the answers. Generally, you know, I think the people who come into the specialisation program in neurology come for the right reasons, like they're hoping to develop their skills, they're really hoping to learn a lot along the journey. I don't think they're coming because they want the title and want to be held up as, you know, having all the answers. You know, they're coming into the program because they want to learn.
Back to students for a second. When we're talking about the shades of grey that exist when we're, you know, dealing with people on the, you know, specialisation pathway, would you try and stick to acknowledging those shades of grey in the early days with students, or would you try and teach them a more black and white approach, letting them know that there are shades of grey in the middle and they can sort of fill in the gaps themselves, balancing that this is the one way to do it, this is another way to do it, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in between?
Yeah, and so I think the most important thing to teach students is, as you say, you know, show them where the evidence is, give them some examples of some effective strategies for whatever problem you're attempting to address, but developing good evaluation skills so that they can see, oh, that is not working. And as long as you're developing those skills, now whether they're, you know, observational skills, using objective measures, getting good engagement with the patients and using the patient's feedback, you know, I think if you're developing those skills in the future generation of physios, then hopefully you won't end up with someone who is banging on doing the same exercise day in, day out, and it's not actually changing anything for the patient.
So, Prue, the other thing we wanted to explore with you is all of the different committees, councils, and working groups that you've been on over the years. Some of the things we have found out you've been involved in have been really important projects like the stroke guidelines and the World Confederation of Physical Therapy. So how did you start yourself up and getting involved in these things? And for people out there looking for these opportunities, what advice would you give them?
So possibly my current advice is I need to learn to say no. But as a, you know, early physiotherapist in my career, I guess, you know, take the opportunities, be brave. There will always be someone who will be happy to help you out. So often it started off just with putting my hand up for the Victorian Committee of the Neurology Special Interest Group, and, you know, starting off with that, that was fairly comfortable, or going on, you know, local sort of conference planning or seminar groups at my hospital. You know, we planned some sort of seminars that were often multidisciplinary. They involved sort of medical, nursing staff. You'd put your hand up, oh, yep, I'll come on that committee. And, you know, as you develop your skills, you start to be interested in other areas. So until a few months ago, like, I found myself as the chair of the Lifespan Committee of the American Academy of Cerebral Palsy and Developmental Medicine. I'm like, good Lord, what am I doing as the chair of that? It's a little Australian from my Melbourne breakfast bar running these meetings with all these big wigs in America. But, you know, sometimes I said, you need to be brave, you know, put your hand up. There will always be people who will help you and mentor you. And even if it's not in a more formal arrangement, sometimes informal sort of mentoring arrangements can come to fruition. So, for example, I ended up being involved in the World Confederation of Physical Therapy projects through my ex-grade one, little Jonathan Kruger, who was a grade one of mine back in the dark days at Royal Melbourne Hospital. And he reconnected with me saying, hey, Prue, we're wanting someone with some neuro skills to, you know, come on this project. Would you be interested? Or if you're not interested, could you, you know, suggest someone else? And so, again, it's about making connections with people. You know, I think if you're always quite active in your profession, you keep you've got a range of different networks that you can tap into or call on or link people together. And I often, once you start, you know, doing one committee, you get a bit committee addicted. You find yourself on every committee. But, you know, that's, you know, I think it certainly, it's, you know, enriches your ability to share your knowledge, whether it's through, you know, working with universities or with your health networks or with, you know, APA groups or any other opportunities that you have to be involved. Often there comes, you know, expressions of interest come around from various groups who are seeking committee members, and often people say, oh, you know, I couldn't possibly do that. No, you know, put yourself forward, you know, why not?
Yeah, I think that's really great advice to just, you know, sometimes you just got to take that first step, don't you? It sounds like these committees have really added to your kind of sense of professional pride and added to your career experience and something that has made it really enjoyable for you.
Absolutely. You know, it's you know, very, very rewarding now when I'm working with our World Physio Project. We're working with some universities in Vietnam to help them upskill their physiotherapists, particularly as a result of their government recognising that the outcomes for people with stroke, head injury, cerebral palsy in Vietnam, they're not great. And so working backwards from that, their government said, well, hang on, how can we improve the outcomes? And they actually unpacked it and worked out, well, actually, we need to develop better skills in clinical reasoning, in using evidence, in our therapists who are actually delivering care. And so it's been really very rewarding, although a bit frustrating over Zoom, to work with, you know, a number of universities in Vietnam to now see they've now launched the Vietnam Physical Therapy Association, which is really exciting. They didn't ever have a professional association of their own before. They now have got their new national curriculum approved, which they are hoping they'll then submit for sort of international accreditation. And essentially it's benchmarked with other sort of examples of, you know, quality physiotherapy practice across a number of other countries. And so that's really exciting for them.
That's really cool to be able to have that influence internationally and kind of almost be doing aid work as well. Hopefully you get over there to see your good work in real life.
I was going to say maybe they might hold their first conference or something in Ha Long Bay and you can be invited and sit there with a cocktail maybe.
Very enjoyable.
One of the other things I just wanted to say before we finish is you said before that, you know, you have a problem with saying yes all the time. But I think yeah, it's one of the things that we've got. We're so lucky to have people like yourself and many other people that have come on our show to discuss, to be, you know, really great facilitators in our industry. And, you know, you certainly sit amongst those. So thank you for saying yes too often.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation to come and chat this afternoon.
No problem at all.
Yeah, thanks so much, Prue. Is there anything else you want to add before we finish up?
Just that, you know, I think, you know, I've been very fortunate in where my career has sort of fallen in terms of neurology, coming into neurology at a time where, you know, the motor skill learning program was only a relatively new textbook by Carr and Shepherd, and, you know, it was sort of a brave new world, and all of the advances that have now progressed to the point where, you know, I think neurological physiotherapists are, you know, pretty much universally very well respected by all members of their teams, as well as by the patients that they provide services to. And it's been wonderful to be a part of that journey.
Oh, that's wonderful. Hopefully we keep along that pathway.
Thank you very much, Prue.
Okay.
Well, it was very cool to get to bring you an episode dedicated to a cohort like adults with CP, which many of us come across but don't always see enough of to develop specific skills. It's great that many countries have specialised services, but from what Prue was saying in the episode, that's clearly not enough, and physios in the community and inpatients alike need to develop skills in this area.
We look forward to bringing you more and varied topics in 2022. We're looking forward to branching out beyond physios a little bit more, so please get in touch if you have any requests for any subject areas. We're on Twitter and Facebook at A Neurophysio, or our website, aneurophysio.com, or over email at aneurophysiopodcast@gmail.com. And if you're enjoying the content, please feel free to give us a rating on whatever application you're using and listening to this on.
May 2022 be very neuroplastic fantastic for you all.